near Tiger Shark. I first saw your image in an article when I was 12, nearly a decade after your death. Your image sent shivers down my spine. Perhaps it was the murky green liquid that you floated in, or your teeth just visible in your sinister, almost smiling mouth. Or perhaps it was just your sheer size that awed me. The thought of standing near to you, of confronting your prehistoric form, thrilled me. You, the apex predator, nightmare of the deep, whom I would never wish to encounter in your own world. Yet here was a way to meet you, to awe at your form without submerging even a single toe. My 12-year-old self had visited aquariums and museums, of course, yet somehow you seemed far more enthralling than the small, far from frightening specimens that swam through shark tunnels or the dried-out skins stretched over fiberglass models and hung from dusty ceilings. You were art. You were art like no art I had seen before. Suddenly, art didn't need to be a landscape painted in oils or a bust carved from marble. Ironically, to me, you represented art that was vital and alive, opposing the procession of dead French painters that we had learned about in school. At the time, I was unaware of your title, and yet the weight of your meaning was clear to me. To stand in front of you was to contemplate one's own mortality, to struggle with the inevitability of a death that we spend our entire lives trying to avoid, something that a 12-year-old me was fascinated by. A few years later, I saw another image of you. This one, perhaps even more frighteningly, pictured you with a gaping maw, making visible your large pointed teeth and deep throat. This time, not swimming peacefully through murky waters, but instead poised to attack as though earning your reputation of man-eater. I learned that your change in posture came about because of a change of shark. Your first body, inexpertly preserved and tampered with by the gallery, had begun to rot, and so, upon the sale of the work, the death of a replacement shark was commissioned. This body, your second, was preserved more thoroughly and poised more aggressively. It opened up a stark question. Were you the same artwork I had seen all those years before? In description, you were identical. Glass, painted steel, silicon, monofilament, shark, and formaldehyde solution. The intention behind the work remained the same, and yet your body and its posture were very different. I imagined that were your two bodies placed side by side, they would elicit different responses. But then again, I've never met you in person, in either of your incarnations, so I could be wrong in my assumption. A then 18-year-old me grappled with a new recognition of animal mortality within the work. Your deaths, which had been veiled to my younger self by a human-centered reading, were revealed by this word, commissioned. You were not creatures found washed up on a beach, or otherwise dead of natural causes, but carefully chosen and hunted, fitting the right specification. You were killed for art, not a byproduct of some other industry being given a noble use, not a sad occurrence used to highlight the plight of sharks, but commissioned to die in order for humans to contemplate their own fragile lives. Nevertheless, you awakened me to possibilities that have led me to my current position, and for this, I will always feel grateful. Yours, Beth. Dear Piglet, many young artists dabble with taxidermy. In recent years, it's become something of an art school cliché. You were my experiment. Stillborn, you were not destined to end up on a plate like your siblings. You were to be consumed in a different way. I won't pretend aesthetics didn't play a role in my choice to try out my tanning skills on you. Your smooth pink skin offered a contrast to the fur and feathers I had used in previous works. Ethically, too, I felt my conscience was clear. As a meat eater, I could hardly shy away from your lifeless form, just because it hadn't been carved up, sanitized, and wrapped in a plastic tray. I had read books and seen pictures and watched videos online of men with scalpels and hunting knives and borax. I set up a workspace in the garden of my student flat. Unsurprisingly, my flatmates were not keen on me working in the kitchen. I knew where to cut and to be careful not to puncture your organs. I carefully loosened your skin and peeled it back as though undressing you. It felt intimate, like you were revealing secrets to me. I discovered the textures and contours of your body, the sinews and fibers. But once I had removed your skin, carefully preserving your delicate ears, lips, and snout, I felt differently about you. It was clear to me that you were not meat. Your skinless body might have been any small mammal. Your lidless eyes, dulled by the freezer, stared back at me, unseeing, but seemingly penetrating my flesh as I had penetrated yours. I realized I had never really seen an animal like this, disrobed but unbutchered. You were not pork, not bacon, nor gammon, not carcass, but corpse. Carefully, I swaddled you in plastic and placed you back into the freezer. Steeling myself, I turned my attention back to your skin, gently teasing it back into shape, laying it flat and scraping the inside before rubbing salt over its surface, making sure to get into every crevice. This, far more than handling your muscle and bone, seemed like cooking. The process similar to curing. Pack the meat in salt and leave it to draw the moisture out. There was a time when I was vegetarian. I had decided that because of my research, I could not justify eating meat. You were always there at the back of my mind. But it was a long time after our encounter that I made this change. Extended family seemed perplexed by my decision. "But surely you can eat carbonara," I was asked. "It only has a little bit of bacon in it." After 2 years, new concerns edged their way into my consciousness. I became aware that my green beans were coming from Egypt, my broccoli from Poland, and my avocados from Tanzania. Eating locally and seasonally became my focus, and with that, a return to meat. Less than I had eaten before, and from different sources, but still, for a reason even unknown to me, the memory of your skinless body did not seem enough to deter the slow return of meat to my plate. At the time of our encounter, I had consoled myself that I had not commissioned your death, that using your body in my artwork was better than it being incinerated and wasted completely. But perhaps I was wrong. I may not have been directly responsible, but I was implicated, part of a system of consumption and production that had bred you for food. Perhaps as art, you might have helped convey some message, but you never even got that far. A disastrous crit halted my progress as a vegan classmate became very upset by my work. For the sake of the friendship, I changed my approach, and you never became anything more than a cured skin. Yours regretfully, Beth. Dear Bunny, you are always a source of inspiration, at once pet, pest, food, and fur. As a young child, I had played rabbits with my friends, pretending we were in Farthing Woods or Mr. McGregor's garden. One summer, I decided I would live as a rabbit, eating lettuce and carrots and communicating by wiggling my nose and rubbing my face with my paw. I never had a pet rabbit, but plenty of my friends did, but they never seemed to live for long. Perhaps because, living in the countryside, even domestic rabbits were not safe from foxes and myxomatosis. Or perhaps it was the good-natured neglect they received from their young owners. "It's healthy for children to learn about death," said parents. Or else they bought new rabbits and came up with excuses for why Flopsy had changed from white to grey overnight. Rabbits and death. Death and rabbits. I found your body by the side of the road. A roadkill rabbit. Surprisingly undamaged. The way your body lay on the verge, you might have been sleeping. I did not disrobe you as I had done the piglet, but kept you whole and just how you were. You went on to be the star of many artworks. Perhaps the one I treasure the most was the performance we made on a small patch of green in amongst the warren-like halls of residence in Dundee. You lay on the grass under a tree while I read to you from Watership Down. I read to you of cowslips warren and rabbits sacrificed to the hunter's snare in return for food and shelter. I read to you of the anthropomorphic grief of fictional rabbits. And you lay on the grass, cold and indifferent, the physical manifestation of rabbit mortality. Theorists discuss the animal turn in art, with many artists presenting the animal corpse for viewers' consideration. Joseph Beuys explained art to a dead hare. Steve McQueen filmed flies settling on a dead horse in a field. And Polly Morgan's intricate taxidermy sculptures place the animal corpse as an object of aesthetic appreciation. But of course, the animal medium is not a new concept. But these animal deaths are not always so explicit. The old master's work is full of dead animals too, from the rabbit skin gesso used to prime the canvases, to pigments made from insects. Ivory and scrimshaw too, ornately carved or painted, and squirrel fur brushes said to be the best for watercolour. To look around the gallery is to witness a historic genocide. Studies drawn from taxidermy, vast still-life masterpieces depicting the spoils of the hunt. Limp, dull-eyed pheasants, foxes and grouse, and of course, rabbits. Their corpses painted from life. Is a video of a dead horse all that different? Or a performance of reading to a dead rabbit? You didn't seem to mind. All my love, B. To the creature who sends a shiver down my spine, whose name I can barely bring myself to say out loud for fear that my utterance might summon you, might conjure you up like some demon from another realm. I know that you are there when I enter the room. I can sense you even before I see you. Mostly, you keep to the shadows, but here you are, bold as brass, standing in the middle of the carpet, watching me. Then, before I know what's happening, before I can think what to do, you burst into a run, skittering across the floor, and disappear under the sofa. Shit. That's it. I can never go back into that room again. But I can't leave either. What if you emerge when my back is turned and I find you lurking somewhere else? What if, like those times that still give me shivers, you run up the curtains just as I'm dropping to sleep, or I find you clinging to the clean washing, which, now contaminated by your touch, must be washed and dried again. I am frozen to the spot, staring at where you disappeared. Then my mind kicks into action, and I dash as quick as I can to the kitchen, tearing open the cupboard under the sink. My hand closes around a cold red spray can. On my way back through the hall, I pause and slip my shoes on, an extra line of defense, before creeping towards the living room. But as I approach the doorway, I catch a glimpse of you scuttling along the skirting and out across the hall and into the bathroom. Steeling myself, I follow you slowly, not making any sudden moves. I peer around the door, and there you are, halfway between the bath and the toilet. Suddenly, I pounce, my arm outstretched, my finger pressing on the valve of the can in my hand, unleashing a cloud of acrid chemicals. You parry by changing direction, running straight towards me. I leap out of the way, keeping the stream of poison directed at you, soaking you until I am sure that you will not survive. You slow, stumbling against the bath panel, before coming to a halt. Legs still writhing, I lift my foot and I put you out of your misery with a soft crunch. I am truly sorry. I sit here minutes later, adrenaline still coursing, feeling bad that I can't work up the courage to leave you be, or else to relocate you safely outside. But you didn't keep up your end of the bargain. I know you live here with me, in the cracks of the skirting and where the pipes disappear into the wall. And I can deal with that if I don't see you, if I can pretend I'm alone. But now you have put me into a state of panic. Every shadow catches my eye. Every piece of fluff on the carpet makes me look twice. Too afraid to get up in the night for a pee in case you are there, running across my foot in the dark. I am told that peppermint and walnuts and conkers and lemons will keep you out if I place them strategically around the home. But the problem is, no one seems to have told you. I am told that my horror lies not with your kind, but with what you represent, that your unpredictability and quick movements trigger a long-repressed anxiety about an unpredictable parent, or that my fear is rooted deep in evolution. But these assertions are unhelpful as I try to live side by side with you. So please, for your sake as much as mine, keep to the shadows, keep out of my space, and perhaps we can just about get along. Dear Damien, they say you are responsible for over 1 million deaths, your own animal genocide. Among the dead are 13 sheep, 7 cows, 5 calves, 1 brown bear, 17 sharks, and 17,000 butterflies, not to mention the countless houseflies and other miscellaneous remains. Of course, you are not the only artist to use animal death as art spectacle. Kim Jones burned a cage of live rats as a performance which reflected on his time serving in the Vietnam War. Marco Evaristi left goldfish in blenders for viewers to press the buttons should they so wish. And Huang Yongping's Theatre of the World asks the audience to witness food chain in action as a collection of insects and lizards eat each other over the course of the exhibition. Do you feel any remorse for the lives you have taken? You were responsible for several awakenings in my developing practice. At 12, you showed me that art could be more than painting. At 14, I learned that art is the idea, and the artist's hand need not build the work. At 18, I realized your art was a business, and that money made doors open. But the loudest message I got from your art was that animals die so that humans can talk about death. Is art any more or less a reason to kill than food or clothing? There is sometimes a morbid poetry at play in your art. The maggots eat the rotting flesh, become a fly, lays eggs and dies. The full cycle of life on display. I agree that watching this cycle play out in front of your eyes is more affecting than seeing it described in a diagram. And why shouldn't a meat eater be confronted with the innards of a cow? But is this a justification for the sheer numbers of animals that have died in the name of your art? Your work embodies the paradigm in which we live. Animal death for human consumption. I am complicit in this too. You recognize that many of the animals you use are institutionally and routinely killed without comment, but you do not engage critically with this. Rather, you use it to shrug off the critics, to justify your genocide. Your art makes me question the inconsistencies and contradictions of my own life and work. And this is something for which I am both resentful and grateful. Yours sincerely, Beth Savage.